So we're discussing the, we're comparing and contrasting the spiritual body of Krishna, which Brahma describes in this verse, with our own body, which is quite the opposite. We can only see with one organ. One part of our body can see, and one part can touch, and one part can smell. And just to... actually, one person does some very nice preaching here, and that is one of our lady preachers in the Bhagavatam. Her name is Rukmini Devi. She's a very good preacher. And she preaches about the difference between the material body of an ordinary mortal man like us, or mortal woman, and the spiritual body of Krishna. Because she had heard about Krishna from Narada Muni and other rishis that passed through the palace, and just by hearing about the sweet form of Krishna, the Rupa Madhurya, and the sweet pastimes, Leela Madhurya, Vena Madhurya, and Prema Madhurya, she became completely sold out to Krishna, and she couldn't think of anyone else but Krishna. Day and night she dreamed of him and drew pictures of him and talked about him, although she had never saw him or met him. And she had paintings on her wall drawn of him. And in this way she was absorbing herself just by hearing about Krishna and thinking about him. So then one time, after she finally attained Krishna as her husband, Krishna was joking with her, and he said, "Really, you made a mistake, because a lot of people make fun of me, because they say, what is this Dwarkadish? Is he a Kshatriya? What is his actual bloodline? What is his caste? Is he a Kshatriya or is he a Vaishya? Or in his boyhood he was running behind cows and covered with dirt and cow dung and playing with in the water. Then somehow his family, he moved to Mathura, and then he associated with royalty, and then he became wealthy and started dressing himself as a king and tried to cover his real identity, that he was just a lowly coward boy from some insignificant village named Braj, and he was prating around with his new identity. And then all of a sudden then people were getting on to, you know, who he was and what he was all about, because it was only a few kilometers from his native place, so people were sometimes making fun of him in Mathura, that really we know what you're all about. So then he thought, well, let me move to a faraway place where nobody knows me, and nobody can bring up any false rumors and make any kind of idea like, you're a coward boy, I know you were just across the river, you played over there in Vrindavan. So he went far, far away, practically out of India. He went to Dwarka. Nobody knew him over there, and nobody could say anything bad about him. So he thought he could fool everybody over there and get away with, you know, being a king. But still, Jarasan, Shishupal, Dantavakra, and others, they would poke fun at him and mock him and jeer at him and say, what is you? You're not a real Kshatriya. You're like a actor pretending to be a Kshatriya. And then even though he was in Dwarka, he still suffered rumors in the hands of, Satrajit and those persons. Satrajit, yeah. He made a rumor about him and being murdered his brother at Prasena. So Krishna had a hard time in Dwarka. So knowing all those things, he was playing one day with Rukmini, and he said that, really, I think you can still reconsider, because Jarasandha is still there, Shishupal is there, Dantavakra, and they're very powerful, rich kings, and they have big kingdoms. They could take you on, and you could still go with them. So then she had a reply to that, which is very nicely depicted in the 10th canto of Bhagavatam, chapter 59 in the Krishna book, and chapter 60 in the BBT edition. And I like to read her preaching, because Rukmini is one of our great preachers, because she's Chandravali, eternal associate of the Lord. And so she preaches to Krishna to show how much she's understood about what's really valuable in life, and what's worth attaining, and what's not worth attaining, and what the difference is, the tangible, real difference between the material body and the spiritual body of Krishna. Rukmini said, "My dear Lord, you advise me to select one of the princes, such as Shishupal, Jarasandha, or Dantavakra. But what is their position in this world? They are always engaged in hard labor to maintain their household life, just like bulls working hard all day and night with an oil-pressing machine. going around in a circle, and there's big stones, and they put seeds in there, and they grind them and make oil. And so the bull goes around in a circle day and night, grinding these seeds. So she's comparing these princes to them. They're just embroiled in family life and completely engaged day and night like an ox, like a bullock. They are compared to asses, beasts of burden. They're always dishonored like dogs, and they are miserly like cats. They have sold themselves like slaves to their wives. This is Rukmini preaching, right? It's pretty good. So now, Vishnu Chakravartipad, he explains why is Rukmini Devi using all these particular animals to compare a husband. She compares a husband to a bullock, to an ox, to an ass, to a cat, to a dog. So here's what she says. Vishwanath, he says, Rukmini compares a husband to a dog because their wives always disrespect them and behave inimic. And also, a husband is compared to a dog because a husband behaves inimically to any outsiders when he's protecting his home. And Rukmini compared husbands to cats because they are selfish and cruel. And also because the husbands have to eat the remnants of their wives. And such material husbands, Rukmini compared them to asses, gutta, because their wives sometimes kick them. So now Rukmini goes on to say more about material husbands in verse 45. Any unfortunate woman who has never heard of your glories, she will accept such a man as her husband. But a woman who has learned about you will never accept another one but you as her husband. A man within this material world is just a dead body. In fact, superficially, the living entity, the Atma, Jivatma, is covered by this body, which is nothing but a bag of skin decorated with a beard and mustache, hairs on the body, nails on the fingers, and hairs on the head. Within this decorated bag are bunches of muscles, bundles of bones, pools of blood, always mixed with stool, urine, and mucus, bile, and polluted air, enjoyed by all kinds of different germs and insects. A foolish woman accepts such a dead body as her husband. In total misunderstanding, she loves him as her dear companion. This is possible only because such a woman has never tasted the ever blissful flavor of your lotus feet. It's a good, pretty good wife, huh? Krishna is like really drinking this like nectar. So Rukmini is preaching very nicely. So Vishnu Chakravartipad writes a verse that Sri Krishna is the real husband for all women at all times. Rukmini considered that although the sweetness of Krishna's lotus feet is well known, and although Krishna possesses an eternal spiritual body full of transcendental knowledge and bliss, foolish women reject him. An ordinary husband's body is covered outside by skin and hair and filled with blood, stool, flesh, bile, and so on. So that's very nice. I used to like that section in the Bhagavatam. Rukmini's preaching. So anyway, like that. Can appreciate for what it is. So this statement of Srimati Rukmini Devi describes the spiritual blissful nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead's body, which is completely different from the material limbs and senses of ordinary embodied souls. So another point about this whole the spiritual nature or transcendental nature of Krishna's body is given in the 7th canto of Bhagavatam. When Hiranyakashipu approached Brahma after his intense austerities, he wanted a boon or benediction of immortality and invincibility and sovereignty over the entire world, and ultimately he wanted to be Brahma. So when demigod Brahma blessed Hiranyakashipu, he would not be killed by different varieties of living entities, right? So then it's significant because he didn't want to be killed by animal, man, and all these things. So Brahma said that no one alive or dead would kill Hiranyakashipu. This means that Hiranyakashipu could be killed. This means both that Hiranyakashipu could be killed by the claws of Nrisingadev, because the nails are considered neither alive nor dead, the nails on the body. And also that Hiranyakashipu could be killed by the spiritual form of Nrisingadev, which is neither alive in the same way any material bodies are alive nor dead. Krishna presented the form of Nrisingadev to Hiranyakashipu. He perfectly fulfilled Brahma's benediction that he wouldn't be killed by anybody alive or dead. So Krishna is not alive or dead. He's transcendental. He's completely spiritual. Just like our soul. Our soul is not alive or dead, right? It's not, you know, it's just eternally there. Anitya. So that's it for 32. I'll go to 33. Any questions about this spiritual body of Krishna? If you want to read again Rukmini's teachings, they're in 10th canto of Bhagavatam, chapter 60, verse 44 and 45, or chapter 59 of Krishna book, text 33. We can read together on page 54, if you like. Advaitam achutam anadam ananta rupam adyam purana purusham navayovanam cha Vedesha durlavam adurlavam atma bhakto govindamari purusham tamaham bhajami. One of the series of four verses, 32, 3, 4, and 5, which give the definition of God and establish the supreme position of Krishna. Translation. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is inaccessible to the Vedas, but obtainable by pure unalloyed devotion of the soul, who is without a second, who is not subject to decay, who is without a beginning, whose form is endless, and who is beginning an eternal Purusha. Yet he is a person possessing the beauty of blooming youth. So this verse is entitled Krishna's Transcendental Nature, or Krishna, the Lord of Contradictions. You know contradictions? Yeah, opposites, right? Krishna is never born. It's like it says Anadim, no beginning, right? Anadim. He has no beginning, but he's born from Devaki and Vasudev Devaki Nanda, and he's born from Yashoda Nanda. So he's never born, but he's born. And he's the oldest, he's Purana Purusham, he's the oldest person, but he's only 16. And all these, this is all contradictions. You can't understand him. It says, you can't understand him by the Vedas. He says he's inaccessible, he's Durlabham, right? Vedeshu Durlabham. You can't understand him. Oh, but you can understand him. Oh, wait a minute, you just said you can't understand him. You can't understand him by the Vedas, but you can understand him by devotion. Oh, okay, yeah, what else? His form is, he's Ananta Rupami, his form is endless. But I see there's a front and there's a back. You know, he's Krishna. He has a human-like form. What do you mean? He's 5'11", and he's like, the, you know, he's human-like form. It's not endless, he has height and width and length and, you know. So all these things, he's a lord of contradictions, so the purport. Advaita means indivisible truth, who is knowledge absolute, or as the translation says, one without a second. Brahma, or Brahman, the infinite, emanates from him as his effulgence, and God immanent, Paramatma, as his constituent. But nevertheless, he remains one and indivisible. So although the infinite Brahman effulgence emanates from him, and although he expands himself in one form as Paramatma, he nonetheless remains one and indivisible. he's really full of contradictions. He's indivisible. You can't divide him, but he has millions and millions of parts. In every atom, there's a Krishna, a Paramatma. every single atom. We're sitting on Krishna, we're breathing Krishna. He's everywhere in his Kala Amshas, parts. Achyuta means that though myriads of avatars, means all kinds, emanate from him as subjective portions, and millions of separated or jivas as separated spiritual particles, still he remains intact as the undivided whole of fullest perfection. Though he indulges in exhibiting pastimes of birth, etc., he is still without a beginning. Though he disappears after the pastimes of his appearance, still he's eternal. Though he's without origin, yet he is with an origin in his pastime of appearance. And although eternal in essence, he is still a person in the full bloom of youth. The sum and substance of it is that, though he possesses diverse and apparently mutually contradictory qualities, still they are in universal harmonious concordance by dint of his unthinkable potency. In other words, the underlying point here is that although Krishna possesses many types of apparently, many types of contradictory qualities, they're all harmonized in every respect by his inconceivable potency known as Achintya Shakti. That's interesting. That's like anything. Krishna has all kinds of potencies. He has like the anything potency. Like if you don't understand something, I don't understand that. Oh, well, that's one of Krishna's energies. It's called the misunderstanding potency. It's called the bewilderment potency. Oh, I understand. And then when you understand something, I understand this thing about Krishna. Oh, that's due to another potency of Krishna. It's called the Vidya Shakti. That's called the understanding potency. So there's Krishna has one potency for one thing, another potency, so he has potency for everything. It's like unlimited flavors of food or something. So, I don't understand Krishna. Oh, yeah, that's his illusory potency. You're in Maya, so you don't understand. Oh, now you understand. Oh, now you're in Yoga Maya. So, it's a Chintya Shakti. This is what it's meant by Chit Dharma, as distinguished from the material. Krishna's graceful threefold bending form with flute in hand possesses eternal blooming youth, and above all unwholesomeness that is to be found in limited time and space. Unwholesomeness means immorality. In the transcendental realm, there is no past and future, but only the unalloyed and immutable present time. In the transcendental sphere, there is no distinction between the object and its qualities, and no such identity as is found in the limited mundane region. Hence, those qualities that seem to be apparently contradictory in light of mundane conception, limited by time and space, exist in agreeable and dainty concordance in the spiritual realm. How can the jiva realize such unprecedented existence? In other words, how can we experience this sublime realm of Krishna's world? The limited intellectual function of the jiva is always contaminated by the influence of time and space, and therefore is not in a position to shake off this limitedness. In other words, we can't avoid time and space. We're trapped in it. We're surrounded by it. We're controlled by it. Everyone's controlled by time. And everyone's situated somewhere in space, located somewhere in space. Sometimes we say in ISKCON that someone's spaced out. But they're not really out of space. They're still in space. But maybe their mind is in one place and their body's in another place or something. They're misplaced, but they're not out of space. But we say spaced out. So this, by being located and confined and controlled by time, kala, and space, then we're limited, because we can't perceive that the spiritual world is timeless, and there's no space, it's unlimited, it's everywhere. Like sometimes people, they ask a child, where's the kingdom of God? And then the child will say, up there. Say, really? Like, kingdom of God is up there. What about down there? Oh no, that's Hades. That's hell down there.
Acha.
What about over there? No, that's New York. No, that's New Delhi. That way. Or that way's Hardwar. Or that way's Rameshwaram. No, but it's not like that, because the spiritual world is everywhere. It's within you, it's without you, it's above you. Krishna's, the spiritual world is above and below and to the left and to the right. It's everywhere. It's not that when you want to go in a rocket ship back to Godhead, you have to, okay, go up. You go holy, go up. We can go down and go end up in the spiritual world. It's everywhere. It's explained that this whole material creation is just a dark cloud floating in the Brahma Jyoti. So the spiritual, the domain is all on every direction around the whole material universe, whole material creation, right? And the first canto explains the material creation just like a dark cloud. If you look in the sky, you see a dark cloud. Well, on all sides of that cloud, there's sky. Above the cloud, there's sky. Below, right, left, on everywhere, there's sky. And it's just placed there. So whole material creation, which is only one-fourth of the totality of the Lord's creative expanse, it's just one little dark cloud in the corner of the sky. What sky is that? That's the spiritual sky. And it's all everywhere. It's surrounded by the spiritual sky. So when you get into dimensions and time and space, then you're stuck. We're stuck here in this land of limitation, this land of time and space, length, width, and depth. And we spend our entire days and nights trying to measure everything. Measure ourselves against another. Measure ourselves against the world. Measure the outer world. Measure the inner world. Measure, draw conclusion, and pass judgment. But this is a waste of time. But that's all that people do in the material world. They spend their time, all their time in space, calculating, measuring, and making judgment. So when Jesus started to teach his students, his disciples, he said, "Listen, fellas, judge not, lest ye be judged." Give up this judging business. Give up the calculation business. Give up the measurement business. That's when one comes into the realm of sadhana bhakti, in Vaidhi sadhana, he also brings calculation with him. So he says, "Oh, if I do this, what will I get out of it? Oh, if you fast on this day, it's equal to 1,000 ashrameda yajnas. You get as much punya as if you lived for 1,000 kalpas on a Triveni and took every auspicious bath." I remember once we were in Kumbh Mela in 1989 for 1 month. Somehow we got trapped over there. And we were just so happens we were giving some classes, and we wanted to get the devotees want to hear some classes on Vrindavan. So I was giving some classes, I'm reading as usual, just reading my notebooks or something. Reading something from Mathura Mahatmyam by Rupa Goswami. And in there he quotes some verses. He says, "For one who lives in Vrindavan, if one lives and comes and stays for one day in Vrindavan, he gets as much purity, he gets as much punya and sukriti as if he lived for 1,000 kalpas on the banks of the Ganga at the Triveni and Kumbh Mela, and took all the auspicious baths at Amavasya and Ekadasi and Purnima, simply by staying one day in the land of Mathura Mandala." So I read this, and everybody, someone raised their hand and said, "Oh Maharaj, what are we doing here? Let's go back to Vrindavan." I said, "Yeah, that's right, what are we doing here?" So then I asked a question. I said, "Well, what are we doing here? Why are we here?" Someone said, "To preach." I said, "All right, there's the answer. To preach." So we were there to do Harinam. Every day we were taking the, all those Gurnitai Didis out from the Padayatra, and Dinabandhu was leading Kirtan, and Lokanath Swami, and it was quite a pretty ecstatic preaching engagement that year, 1989. So a lot of Sankirtan, food distribution, prasad distribution, and book distribution. So this way we were there to benefit others. We already got 1,000 ashrameda yajnas and all that under our belt from living in the holy land of Vrindavan. So we went there to benefit other people that were trying to attain benefit. So we weren't there for calculation, we were there for service. We were there doing prem seva for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and chanting the holy name. to attract people to the sweet realm of Vrindavan and the eternal service of Krishna in the timeless realm of Vrindavan. So this is beyond calculation. But as I mentioned, that some people, when they come into bhakti, they calculate. Well, calculation has to eventually go to the background, because that's something of the material world, time and space. The limited intellectual function of the jiva is always contaminated by the influence of time and space, and is therefore not in a position to shake off this limitedness. So what I was saying here in the last few minutes is that part of this limitation of time and space is that being in time and space, we tend to do a lot of measuring. We're measuring and calculating everything. So then we come into devotional service and we start measuring and calculating also. Calculating our practices, what will I get? But the only thing we really want to get is the pleasure of Krishna and Guru. That's all. We want to see Krishna happy and Guru happy. That's the only calculation. And the only measurement is that, well, there's this piece of straw on the ground. And somehow I have to shrink my ego down and shrink my false conceptions down small enough, you know, shrink my size so I can get underneath that piece of straw on the street. Because that's my location in space. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has defined a place for me in the space. He said, yes, here's your place. You want to play? Hey, where's my ashram? Where's my room? Give me some facility. I want some facility. I need some office. I need a space to do my work. Yeah, here's your place. Your place is Trinadapi Sunichena Sura Ivasahishna. He says, Amanina, he says, Trinadapi. Trina means piece of grass. Trina. He says, your place is underneath the piece of grass. You get under there, you somehow calculate yourself and shrink yourself down to that little bit of space, and you occupy that space underneath a piece of dry straw on the street, and let all the cars and trucks and buses run over you, and all the horses and tempos trample over you, and all the people step on you, step on your mind, step on your ego, step on your misconceptions and false identities and pride and foolishness. And then, when you're completely smashed and crushed and squeezed out to the maximum point, then you can progress in bhakti and actually chant the holy name. But we don't do that. We're not trying to shrink ourselves down to get under the piece of straw. We're always saying, let me see. Looks like Kanishta Adhikari to me. Yeah, must be Kanishta Adhikari. See, I read the books. I know. Yeah. Let's see. Looks like Madhyamadhikari. Some symptoms here. Madhyamadhikari. Acha. Oh, namaste. Pranams. Then. Whoa! Tape measure. Looks like Madhyamadhikari here. Dhanabat Maharaj. Gurudev. So in this way, you know, we're always calculating, measuring, you know, that I'm bigger than you, I'm better than you, or he's better than me. Wow. Okay. Namaste. You know, this is called calculation, because we carry this conception of time and space in our little brains. But Mahaprabhu is trying to smash that by putting us in our place, right? Hey, I put him in his place. Why I put that bhakta in his place? He's not going to try to talk back to me again. Hey, you know who I am? Yeah. Das, Anudas, Anudas. No. That, forget about that. I mean, do you realize who I am? I'm this and that and this and that and so many titles and so many letters of the alphabet. And you should listen, you have to listen to me. Well, I don't want to. The limited intellectual function of the jiva is always contaminated by the influence of time and space, and is therefore not in a position to shake off this limitedness. If the potency of cognitive function does not extend to the realization of the transcendental, what else can? In other words, if my little teeny brain can't extend itself or perceive or understand the spiritual energy or the spiritual world, well, what can? That's what he's saying. Then, in reply, Brahma says, to that question, Brahma answers that the transcendental absolute, Krishna, is beyond the reach of the Vedas. Now, why is that? Because the Vedas are also produced in time and space. So how can time and space get you out of time and space? the bound cannot release the bound. Only the unbound can release the bound. The Vedas originate in sound, and sound originates in the mundane ether. In other words, the basis of the Vedas is sound, and sound is a product of material nature, right? Kam mano buddhir evacha. So kam means sky, ether, space. Then comes air, then fire, then water, then earth. So sound is produced in this ether. So the Vedas cannot present before us a direct view of the transcendental world. Thus the Vedas cannot directly show us the spiritual world. It is only when the Vedas are imbued with the chit potency that they are enabled to deal with the transcendental. It is only when the Vedas are infused with the divine spiritual potency that they can somewhat indicate that spiritual realm. But Goloka reveals itself to every jiva soul when he is under the influence of the spiritual cognitive potency joined to the essence of ecstatic energy. This is an old theme that we're hearing again and again. Still, every jiva can receive revelation of Goloka when that same chit potency influences them with divine cognition, samvit, as a result of the concentrated essence of the potency of divine ecstasy, ladini shakti, which is awakening of the current of devotion in the soul. In other words, when one comes to bhava bhakti, at the platform of bhava bhakti means that one has practiced sadhana bhakti, vaidhi sadhana and raganuga sadhana, to such a point that he is pleased Guru and Krishna. And when Krishna is pleased, he shines the sun of his Vishuddha Sattva potency on the heart of that jiva and fills him with bhav. And that Vishuddha Sattva, that Swarup Shakti, is the personal energy. It's his energy. He has the prerogative, Krishna, he can choose to fill you with his mercy or not, shine his love light on you or not. So his love light, his light of love, his Swarup Shakti is Samvit Shakti and Ladini Shakti, which Brahma is mentioned here in the verse and Jiva is mentioning in the purport. So then, when that Swarup Shakti or Vishuddha, pure goodness, is illuminating the consciousness of the Jiva, then he can see like Brahma saw, he can see the spiritual world, he can see the timeless realm of Goloka, and he can go beyond the limitations of time and space, and perceive and have darshan or spurti of Krishna, hear Krishna's flute, see Krishna's associates. The ecstatic function of devotion is boundless and is surcharged with unalloyed transcendental knowledge. That knowledge reveals Goloka Tattva, the principle of the highest transcendental, in unison with devotion, without asserting itself separately, but as a subsidiary to the to unalloyed devotion. In other words, such perception happens in the heart of the devotee without asserting itself separately. It is exclusive devotion, ananya bhakti alone, which reveals the realm of Goloka. In other words, pure devotion reveals the realm of Goloka. There's some interesting points here in this verse, purport, that we have some notes on. Can read. 33. Thus, the acharyas go over the individual words, because each one of these words in itself is practically a definition of God. Advaitam, achutam, anadam, anantarupam, adyam, purana, purusham, navayovanam. Because people oftentimes, this is part of Sambandha Tattva, understanding very clearly the transcendental identity of God, the difference between God and man. What is God? What is the definition of God? Why serve God? What is God? Why go to God? Why serve God? Why surrender to God? All these questions should, the knowledge that this is called Krishna Tattva, to know and have knowledge of Krishna and understand his nature, it purifies the heart and removes doubts from the soul and enables one to be determined in bhakti. So this is all part of Sambandha Gyan, which is very important to advance in spiritual life. So people will ask us, well, what is God? And what is the definition? How do you define God? Well, you can define God by the six opulences. You can define God by these different characteristics and explaining them. There's so many ways to define God. By his energies, so many ways. So this verse is one definition of God. So these words are there. Advaitam, Advaita. Means he's without a second. In other words, that's the meaning of God. That's the definition the dictionary gives. One who has no equal. Like sometimes people say, you say, well, God means that person, the supreme living entity, the source of all creation, the source of everything. He's the source of everything, the supreme living being. Every living being has come from him. And then some wise guys or wise people, they say, oh, who created God? Or where did God come from? Well, that's the meaning of God. You know, in other words, the buck stops there, as they say in English. The buck means the dollar. The buck stops there. It doesn't go any further than that. That's the meaning of God. That he's the first point, the original point. If you go beyond that, then that's God. In other words, that you can't go any further. The cause of all causes. Like you say, that's another argument for the existence of God. Everything has a cause. You are caused by your mother, by your father, by your grandfather. Well, who's the cause of the original person? Well, I don't know, Adam and Eve or something. Well, who caused Adam and Eve? You know, like that. So then it goes ultimately, well, God. God is the cause of all causes. And that's another thing we have that in another verse, right? Sarvakarana Karnam, Ishvara Parama Krishna, stuff like that. That's another definition. God is the cause. Then some wise guy says, well, who's the cause of God? I say, no. The meaning of God is the absolute truth, the absolute being. That absolute point of infinity which you can't go beyond. That's God. There's no... If you go beyond that, or there's some of the cause of God, then that's God. So here, this Advaitam is like another meaning explanation of God. There's no second. He has no second. But then we see that he divides himself, and he has so many seconds. He has Balaram. Balaram is a second. He's not dual. We say there's no duality. There's no two. There's no two to Krishna. But then we see, wait a minute, there's Krishna and there's Balaram. And there's so many expansions from Balaram. And the Purusha avatars. There seems to be, how can you say there's only one? There's not dual. Not dual means no second. We see seconds, thirds, fourths, fifths. We see millions of amshas and expansions and parts of God. In fact, what are we? We're also part of God. Tatasta jiva. Jiva Shakti, we're also little gods, right, in quality. Or maybe we think we're big gods. But, you know, we're part of God. God is manifested. So how can we say, but this is because he's also, everything is within him, all these different expansions and all these different universes, they're all with, everything is within God. Mayam tatam idam sarvam jagat avyaktimurtina. That's explained 9th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that everything is inside of Krishna and Krishna is inside of everything. So in that sense, there's not two, there's one. There's only one. It's Krishna and everything's within him. So this is one meaning, that he is the one indivisible truth, yet... This is one of the contradiction things, because this is one of the themes of this verse, because the theme of this verse is the Lord of Contradictions. So we say Krishna is non-dual, but then the first canto of Bhagavatam, the sages and rishis, they study the nature of the absolute non-dual reality, or the spiritual reality, and then they say, oh, Vedanti tat tattva vidas yata jgyaram advayam, brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavanti shavite. They say, Vedanti tat tattva vidas. After the Vedantis, those that know the Vedas, they study the Vedas and they say, yes, this non-dual substance, this spiritual reality, it is non-dual, it is one, but it's actually three. It manifests three features, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Bhagavan iti shabyate. So this is a contradiction. He's non-dual, he's Advaitam, but he's Dwait. He's dual. And of course, there's a funny story in Chaitanya Charitamrita about Advaita Acharya. I don't know if it's Chaitanya Charitamrita, maybe it's Chaitanya Bhagavat. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he went to the house of Srivasa Acharya, which is down the road from his house, Srivasangam, very close to his own house, Jagannath Mishra Bhavan. And he called all the devotees there, and he was just giving them whatever they wanted and showing them different avatars, and he was just freely distributing love of God, Krishna Prema Pradayate. So he was giving, he gave love of God. There was one person who was a tailor. He was like a Muslim or something. He had a little shop out, like they have outside the wall here. They have outside the wall the temple guys iron clothes and stuff. So outside the wall of Shiva Sangam, there was this little Muslim tailor. He used to iron dhotis and chadars and, you know, saris or whatever, just like they do nowadays. And then, but he was not offensive, so whenever Nimai Pandit would pass on the way to school, pass down the road, he would be ironing clothes, and then he would look and he would just stop, he would pause from his service of ironing clothes, and he would look and say, such a beautiful boy, so attractive, his long black curly hair hanging over his shoulders, and he walks so tall and proud like a lion going to battle. He's so confident, at such a young age, that boy has such confidence. And I heard he's very learned also. I heard he's a great scholar. They call him Pandit. And he's such a nice boy. Of course, he's a Hindu. But anyway, he's really attractive, beautiful. He's such a nice boy. And then he starts ironing. He says, boy, Nimai, Nimai, Nimai. Like that. So he always, and then sometimes later, the Kirtan party was going by. The Kirtan movement had started, and he was appreciating, but he didn't really take part. Sometimes he would chant a little bit, Hari Bol, Hari Bol. So then Lord Chaitanya, he called him, and he blessed him. He told Srivas, he said, even your, I know that the tailor outside your wall, or not, he's like Dobi type. He said, he is not offensive. And because he's not offensive, I also give him love of God. So Lord Chaitanya was giving love of God to everyone. And he was calling different, the mothers of different devotees and the wives of different devotees, Malini, and all different ladies were coming. But he didn't call Sachi Mata. He didn't call his mother. And then some devotees were saying, but Gaurasundar, you're giving love of God to everyone. What about your mother? Why aren't you giving to your mother? Mother Sachi, she's the Jagan Mata. She's the mother of the whole universe. We worship her. She's a universal mother. She's so kind and loving to everyone. And everyone finds shelter in her. And everyone's supported by her and nourished by her. And enlivened by her and inspired by her. How can you deny her? She's your own mother. And you won't give her love of God? And she said, no, never in a million years I'll give her love of God. Why is that? Why you won't give your own mother love of God? Because she's an offender. She's an aparadi. That's why. She'll never get love of God. Huh? Your mother? Sachi Mata? An aparadi? How can you say such a thing? How is it possible for your mother to be thought of like that, to say such a thing? Well, you don't understand. She made a great offense to Advaitacharya. And until she rectifies that offense and gets and he forgives her, then I'll never give her love of God. So then this news came to Sachi Mata, and then she was feeling rather sad. But then a kirtan started. Sometime later, I think, there was a kirtan. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was dancing in ecstasy, and Nitai, Gadadhar, Garai, Advaitacharya. And Vaidacharya was just looking at Gaurasundar and just completely overwhelmed by his beautiful form, and Garai and Gauranga dancing together, just like Radha Govinda, so beautiful. And he was looking at them and dancing in circles around them in his own majestic way. But you have to understand that Vaidacharya is like 55 years older than Lord Chaitanya. So that when Lord Chaitanya was like 20, he was like 75 years old. So he would dance in a very regal and majestic, you know, way, full ecstasy, but not with the kind of exuberance and abandon of Garai and Gauranga, but very beautiful and very ecstatic, tears coming out of his eyes, and you know. So then he, in a moment of ecstasy, he swooned on the ground, and he kind of went semi-unconscious. And then at that moment, Mother Sachi went, and she took the dust from his feet, and she took her feet, and Mother Sachi took it away to Charya's feet on her forehead, and she begged him, please forgive me, oh Gosai, old way to Gosai, old way to Charya Prabhu, please forgive me. So then he forgave her. And then Lord Chaitanya gave love of God to her. So then they asked, so then Vrindavan Das Thakur says, so the devotees were saying, what was the offense of Sachimata? So then it's explained there that this was her offense. That her eldest son, Vishwarup, was the brother of Lord Chaitanya, Vishwarup. He used to always go and associate with Advaitacharya and hear the Srimad Bhagavatam in the Sangha of Advaitacharya and Jagannanda Pandit, Advaitacharya, and Haridas Thakur. Well, he was just Haridas at that time. Haridas and others, they would gather in Advaitacharya's house, Advaita Bhavan, and before Lord Chaitanya exhibited his pastimes of Sankirtan and discussed Bhagavatam, and they would chant non-Sankirtan together, a small confidential group of Vaishnavas. And then one day, Vishwarup, he left home, and he was always associating with Advaitacharya, and he was becoming very, very detached from material life, and Sachimata was worried, and she would sometimes speak to her husband Jagannath. He says, I don't know about our son Vishwarup. It doesn't look like he's very much interested in marriage, and maybe we should try to marry him because that Advaitacharya, you know, is filling him with detachment by associating with him. So then, on the prompting of Sachimata, Jagannath Mishra, he met with Vishwarup, and he said, Vishwarup, it seems that you're a young, handsome man, and you're qualified now, a very learned Sanskrit pundit and learned in Shastras. I think it is time now proper for you to marry a nice Brahmini girl in a proper way. You should be married. And he said, marriage? What? What are you talking about? I'll never marry. I'm not going to waste my life like this. Enough of this subject. Enough of this talk. The next day, then, by arrangement of providence, a sannyasi came to his house. And he asked Jagannath Mishra, he said, I'd like to take your son Vishwarup traveling with me. And so Vishwarup couldn't say no when he begged charity, so he gave the son, and then Vishwarup left. Because it's all the arrangement, because he went, as soon as he heard about marriage, then he said, forget it, he left. So then Jagannath Mishra, of course, he couldn't bear the separation. He left his body in a separation, just like Dasarath. When Ramachandra was banished to the kingdom, Dasarath left his body also. So in the same way, Jagannath Mishra, he could not bear the separation from his beloved son Vishwarup, so he gave up his body in the fire of separation. So then, one time, Mother Sachi was talking to some of her other lady friends, some Malini and some Sita Devi, the wife of Advaitacharya. She was saying, I don't know if it was Advaitacharya's wife, but some other lady, she was saying, this Advaitacharya, he is not Advaita. He's not Advaita, he's Dvaita. He's called Advaitacharya, which means he sees no duality. Advaita means it's all one. That he doesn't see, you know, my family is his family, is your family, and my husband is your husband, my children, your children. He doesn't see, but he's not Advaita, he's Dvaita. Because he's seeing that my son is not my son, that he should be his son, or he should be renounced. And he's not, and so she made a joke like that. She was just joking that, how does he have the name of Dvaita? He's actually Dvaita. He's seeing duality. He's seeing that my son or his son, and like that, he's seeing duality. So she made this joke because she was a little upset because her son was kind of, she attributed the loss of her son to his sangha, his association with Advaitacharya. So she kind of passed his joke. But Lord Chaitanya heard about that, and he considered that was an aparad to Advaitacharya. And because of that Vaishnava aparad, she was denied Krishna prema. So from this lesson in Chaitanya Bhagavat, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu shows that how extremely careful we have to be in our dealings with one another, not to make Vaishnava aparad. So Krishna is known as Advaita, even though he exhibits his features of Brahman, Paramatman, and Bhagavan. And Prabhupada uses the analogy, it's just like the sun is one. The sun is not dual, it's not divided, it's one. But the sun displays different features. There's the sun planet, there's the sun king who lives on the planet, and then there's the sun shine. So there appears to be duality, there appears to be difference, although there's oneness. So Krishna is one indivisible truth, Advaita, but he exhibits three features of Brahman, Paramatman, and Bhagavan. So the sun is one entity, but exhibits the features of the sun planet, then the Surya Dev, the king of the sun, the lord of the sun, and then his energy, which we perceive on this level, the sunshine. So Krishna is like the, you know, from Krishna emanates the Brahman, and Krishna expands as Paramatma, but they're all one with Krishna, but they come from him. The Brahman is his effulgence, and the Paramatma is his localized representation. So that's Advaita. So on Monday we'll talk about some of the other meanings